This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
Hey, Blake.
Wicked Tiger. He looks proud.
I swiped it from Ms. Rancic's lawn. Wow, your shorts are, like, especially gold today.
My mom uses color-safe bleach.
Go Carol.
I'll tell her.
So guess what?
What? I don't know.
I'm pregnant.
What should we do?
Well, you know, I was thinking I'd just nip it in the bud before it gets worse. Because they were talking about in health class how pregnancy, it can often lead to an infant.
Typically, yeah, yeah. That's what happens when our moms and teachers get pregnant.
So you're cool with that then?
Yeah, yeah, wizard. I mean, you know, just, I guess, do whatever you think you should do, you know?
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Popcorn Culture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and I am, in case you cannot tell, calling in from home today. Joining me also from home is Sharmila Ganesan, while, you know, helming the studio single-handedly is Arvind Yuvaraj. Hi, guys.
Hello, hello.
Hi.
Okay, so this week we have an interesting lineup, and our throwback and our review are somewhat related. As is usual, I think our entire week's worth of content is somewhat related to one another. So let's start with the throwback. So in honor of Throwback Tuesday today, we are going back 13 years to 2007's Juno.
I loved Juno when it came out. I was actually a little afraid to revisit it because it's that kind of particular brand of early 2000 humor, you know, the indie sensibilities. It's a teen story. I'm really glad to say that it actually holds up really well. I mean, 13 years later, I watch it and I feel like you could screen that movie today and it would still feel really fresh. So, I think it's a great throwback because in some ways it feels like it's not a throwback at all.
I can't remember when or where I watched Juno. I don't think I watched it in the cinema. For sure, I didn't watch it in the cinema. I think it was DVD, original, of course.
I watched it on DVD too.
Yeah.
Original, of course, always.
Of course. And it's the movie that made me like Ellen Page a lot. So everything that she did after that, I would check out or try to check out because of Juno.
So to run through the story and the names of the people involved real quick, it, of course, stars, as we've mentioned, Ellen Page. It's written by Diablo Cody. It is directed by Jason Reitman. And it essentially tells the story of a 16-year-old girl who surprises herself in some ways with a pregnancy and through a series of events decides that she's going to stay pregnant and eventually give the baby up for adoption to a pair of adoptive parents, Jason Bateman, Jennifer Garner. And then I guess the story flows on from there.
Mm. And it did win a Oscar for Diablo Cody for Best Original Screenplay. And I think it was a bit of a shock because it's one of those kind of indie comedies that people don't think of necessarily as being Oscar material. And I think when you watch it, it's because you realize that for all that, that's actually a pretty simple story in some ways. I mean, there are no huge surprises. You kind of know where it's heading and it heads there. But it's held together with these brilliant performances. It's got great dialogue. The story moves along so well that you understand why this film deserve that award because it's written so well.
It's not surprising for the most part, except for Juno's parents' reaction to her pregnancy.
Yes.
Because that's not a normal reaction. Like any movie would use that as like a dramatic trope, like to, you know, further some kind of story, some kind of conflict, some big drama. You'd expect J.K. Simmons to turn into Whiplash J.K. Simmons or J. Jonah Jameson J.K. Simmons. But they don't. They just, they kind of joke about it and they take it very casually. They deal with it in their own way, which is unique. Like it was a very interesting creative choice when writing that movie to get her parents to be very casual, very understanding to, you know, teenage problems and what they go through and whatnot. They're not fully 100% on board with it, but they don't oppose her for it.
So the thing that I find interesting is watching this the week after we threw back to Gladiator, because Gladiator is an example of a film that is, I mean, eventually it's a great film, we talked about it, but it began as like all concept, no script, more or less. And this movie, I think, is mostly built on off of the strength of the script. Reading about it, everybody who wanted to get involved essentially said that they wanted to get involved because they read the script and could not imagine not doing it. I think a lot of people took pay cuts to be involved in it, Jennifer Garner, for instance. So I think that the script in this instance is the thing that really holds it all together. And it's a really good script, although it does have that Aaron Sorkin quality of, do people really speak like this? Does everyone always have the exact right thing to say at the exact right moment? But that's part of the pleasure of the film, right? The smart, the intelligentness, the wisecracking, and then without that much of a hint, it'll suddenly head towards pathos. And like, it's a very deep script, and I think it works, everything else works so well because the script is so good.
I think the quality of do people really talk or even behave like this is also the product of that magical combination of people who've come to make this movie together. So you have Jason Reitman, who most of his movies, you're kind of like, do people really have these repartees ready to, you know, whip them out? But also Ellen Page, she's kind of an actress who's really great, but she's an actress who often feels there's something about her that doesn't feel like she's quite real. And not in a bad way, but she really suits these kinds of roles very well. I think this is a great example of a movie that really nobody in this situation would behave this way in real life. But you're kind of really fine with it because this is the best version of life that you could think of. Even the creepy older man potentially turns out to be kind of relatable and fine, and you feel kind of bad for him, which I think is a lot of credit to the movie and the way it's written.
Yeah, but it's also super dated, this film. Like, even when it was made in 2007, it was a very dated film.
So that's why it works, right? Because it never feels like it's in a particular time.
No, even the dialogue that is written for teenagers is obviously written by people who are way older than teenagers. So they use certain kinds of lingo and certain kinds of dialogue that isn't authentic to them. And you can even call it out. You could even call it out back then. And today, when you watch it, it's like, whoa, I have no idea which year this movie is even from, or if it's from some alternate dimension, which is fine, I guess, if you can, like you said, if you can pluck it out as a particular movie from a period in time that you're not exactly sure when it takes place, but it's in a good time.
So this movie in some ways has some evergreen themes, right? The idea of how it is that you deal with surprises, how it is that families come together, the unusual ways that people can fall in love in some instances. But in other ways, a lot of the script, or rather a lot of the movie, hinges on there not being mobile phones. Like, there are so many moments where you would think that if someone had the ability to drop someone else a text before they went by their house, the whole movie would fall apart.
Or just send them a picture rather than walk over and hand it to them. So many things would be different. Yeah,
exactly. But the fact that in this movie, all interactions live and die by the hamburger phone means that, you know, that there are some things that are allowed to happen. And with throwbacks, I think we often either go very far back or we go, you know, midway. But this is an interesting one because they're recognizably of this century. But the lack of ubiquity surrounding mobile phones was interesting to me. I watched it and I thought, oh, I cannot imagine. I was once this teenager, but I don't remember being this teenager and not having access to a mobile phone.
Mm. And it's also been a while, hasn't it, since that idea of people who are really kind of young driving and doing things themselves in cities or spaces, and nobody is like, hey, this is really kind of dangerous. Or like, who lets their kids just like run around or roam around and not care? But then that also goes back to the whole like, hey, your daughter's pregnant. Well, okay, then what shall we do next? So I don't know, it feels like a movie that you can't quite put your finger on sometimes why it continues to work so well. And so I think I keep going back to the fact that it's written so well. There's just a sweetness at the core of how it's written. Sometimes Aaron Sorkin feels like he's trying to pull one over you. This one doesn't feel that way. It feels like you're really there with the writer.
Do you guys like the quirkiness of the film? Because I know it worked back then. Do you still like it now? Because it is very Wes Anderson-ish. And Wes Anderson himself has come under sort of like, you know, critics have called him out for doing the same things over and over again. And this movie tries to be quirky for quirky's sake. Like, there are lots of scenes where you don't exactly know why it's happening, but you know it's being forced into the film because it needs to have this kind of quirky vibe. Do you still like that?
I do, I think. I have a lot of nostalgia for this movie, so that might be it as well. Michael Cera himself is a walking example of exactly that sensibility that you're talking about. There were these like series of movies in the early 2000s that all had that vibe, right? But I like him. I'm the kind who like I'd watch Michael Cera and be like, oh, look, I miss when this was just on screen all the time.
I like it a lot less than I used to, I'm going to be honest. I mean, that particular thing, that whimsical vibe, partly because so many other people have done it.
Yes.
So I think that's a problem. But I will say that the reason why I think it works is because the performances are grounded. So yes, while there are certain things about it that are almost but not quite the manic pixie dream girl trope, almost but not quite, nevertheless, Juno feels very real to me, and her family feels real, even if her little sister's named Liberty Bell, and and the adoptive couple also feel very real to me. And in the same way, Arvin, as you were referring, like as you were talking about relating more to the parents and adults in Ferris Bueller, I related a lot more this time round. I don't know how, you know, so many years on from the first time I watched Juno, to Vanessa and Mark.
Oh, I so agree. And I was thinking of Arvind as well when that happened, because the first time around, I remember thinking of Jennifer Garner's character in particular in very, very judgy ways.
She makes sense.
She's a person.
But now when I watch her, I actually find myself very much on her side and actually understanding her even from the beginning. And Jennifer Garner plays that character very well.
Okay, so we do have to take a break here, but we are going to return and continue talking about the performances and all the rest of what makes Juno work. We're talking today about 2007's Juno on Throwback Tuesday. Did you watch it? Do you remember it? Tell us, you know, you can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. You're listening to Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments, BFM 89.9. The business station.
I'm pregnant.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but I'm going to give it up for adoption, and I already found the perfect couple. They're going to pay for the medical expenses and everything, and...
You're pregnant?
I'm sorry, and if it is any consolation, I have heartburn that is radiating to my kneecaps, and I haven't taken a dump since Wednesday morning.
Who is the kid?
The baby? I don't really know much about it other than... I mean, it has fingernails, allegedly.
Nails, really?
Yeah.
No, I don't. I mean, who is the father, Juno?
It's Polly Bleeker.
Polly Bleeker?
What?
I didn't think he had it in him.
I know, right?
Right, this is no laughing matter.
No, it's not. And you know, Polly is actually great in,
Okay.
In chair.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Arvin, and Shamila. Today on Throwback Tuesday, we are looking at Juno. And we touched on a couple of things, the whimsy of it. Let's go in the other direction. How do you guys think it handled the subject matter? Because this is, I think, one of the biggest things about Juno, one of the sources of controversy back in the day, right? Because it deals with teen pregnancies and it does it in a certain way. What do you guys make of the treatment of that?
Maybe it's the politics. Maybe it's how I've changed my view of these issues. I felt like, even though it doesn't do that so strongly, the slight push towards, if you want to call it pro-lifeness versus pro-choiceness, felt a lot more uncomfortable to me this time around than it did the first time I watched it.
So I think they didn't set out to make this movie to send a message. The way I see it, especially when you watch it the second time and the third time, I think it becomes pretty clear that they chose the subject matter because they wanted to tell the story from a different point of view. I don't think the ending matters at all, whether you know it's pro-life or not. I honestly don't think they set out to say anything or you know comment on that issue whatsoever because it doesn't feel important to the film. What seems important to the film is how she deals with the pregnancy itself and how a teenager who is pregnant is going through that pregnancy and dealing with with the choices that she has, and you know, dealing with her partner who got her pregnant. And I think that's where the movie excels. If you want to dissect it like politically and try to pull apart what they're trying to say, then it is slightly uncomfortable. But again, I don't think that's what they were going for in the first place.
So to me, I think the most important part of the movie actually is how much agency Juno has. Mm-hmm. And it's quite clear through every decision she makes, even in some ways, the decision that led her to become pregnant in the first place is really a decision she made. It's something that everybody says that, you know, Polly Bleeker, her best friend who she had that sexual interaction with, it wasn't really his choice. It was not really on his initiative that it happened. And so I think the thing that stands out to me the first time, the second time, I don't see this changing anytime soon, no matter how many times I rewatch Juno, it's really about how much agency in the decision making that she has. When she decides to do something, she tells the people around her. She's not asking for approval. She's not asking for anything. And so when there are moments where she breaks down, when she feels tired of it, she has no one to blame but herself. And I think that's a complex thing for a teenage movie to deal with, because at that age, it's really easy to say it's the man, it's the teachers, it's the world. But Juno is a teen movie that makes it very clear that no, I mean, it's fine that you're feeling this way, but actually it's just you.
And I think some of the things that that has come up, right, it's almost manic pixie girl, but it's not. It almost takes a moralizing tone, but it doesn't. The agency that's given to the girl. All of this, I think, actually has to do with the fact that it's written by a woman. I think it makes a big difference. We undermine how much a person being given an opportunity to tell this, because it's directed by a man. So it's quite easy to compartmentalize this as a Jason Reitman film. Jason Reitman brings a lot to the table, yes. But I think all of these things is because it's written by a woman.
And also, it's I think one of my favorite parts of the film is how she downplays her own pregnancy, which is, I think it's a character choice. So Ellen Page, when she plays Juno sort of sees the pregnancy as nothingness. It's like everyday life. And that is such a teenage thing to do, like downplay big things and downplay like big dramatic events and pretend like you don't care about them. And obviously she does, because there are scenes in the movie where she, like you said, she does break down and she takes this very seriously. It is a heavy thing that's weighing on her, but she pretends like it's an easy choice for her to make and she doesn't care about the baby, right? Which is, I think, a really powerful thing to show in the film, especially when you're dealing with teenagers, because it's, even if there wasn't a pregnancy, it's just showing that teenagers don't always show you what they're feeling, that they are going through a lot of things, but on the surface they have to play it cool because it's that age bracket, right? You just have, everything's cool, everything's nothing, and I think Ellen Page played that so well.
Yeah, there's a reason why Ellen Page continues to be so strongly associated with Juno. I don't think she's ever really moved on from the character, because it just is her, right? Like, and so the thing about the movie, I think, that feels special and of its time is that I don't know if it could be made today, and I don't know if it could have been made with any other. It feels like a recipe. Everybody in this movie is needed, and it's alchemical. You needed it to come together and be presented like this. I don't know that if you had swapped out any one element of it, I don't know how it would have worked, how it would have tipped over the balance. It's a very well-balanced movie. If occasionally it does feel a little too, what is this, whimsy for whimsy's sake, they immediately course correct. And they do so in a lean and mean, you know, 90-minute film. So I think that there's, yeah, like to me, when I watch it, I'm just like, yeah, this is exactly what it was meant to be.
I completely agree. I think that it's, I go back again to the fact that it's just written with every moving part fitting together really well. And all these people coming together to make something that, I would be hard pressed to really even now look and pick at something that I think doesn't fit or doesn't work. And there's so few movies that you can say that about, really. We say this a lot, I think, in throwback, like they don't make movies like this anymore. But I think that's also something that is important to say, that the a movie like this today would be released on Netflix, let's say. I don't know whether it would get a cinema release. And while we didn't watch it in the cinema, I think there's a joy to being able to watch movies like this as a huge cultural conversation rather than something that is narrowcasted to particular audiences.
I think the length of the film is another telling sign that this is exactly what they intended to do. Going back to what we said before, but you know, what is the message of the film? And I think by giving it that length, they took it in a very casual way. So they wanted to tell this story from a casual point of view. And I also like that because they could have easily made this a very serious, dark drama, you know, because for like award season and stuff, you know, it's easier to make it sad. It's easier to make it depressing. And they could have tackled this in a much different way, in a safer way, but in a much heavier way. And I think it would have still gotten the awards that it got. But deciding to make it quirky, whimsical, very casual, very lighthearted was something that I don't think a lot of filmmakers have done before and a lot of filmmakers haven't done since.
That, and I think it really speaks to the fact that it takes as much effort to make a whimsical, well-constructed movie as it does to make a heavy, well-constructed movie. Mm-hmm. You know, the movie, while short, well, not short, I would argue the correct length. Everyone else has just gone overboard. But the movie is structured along the trimesters, right? The idea of it is that it takes place in seasons. You see the seasons change. And they did that very particularly. You are meant to feel the passage of time. And so, yes, I agree. It's a casual movie. You know, the whip-smart repartee, the light touches, they're all there. But it's also a movie that doesn't waste time and that is constructed to create a very particular mood, to create a particular understanding of what's happening. And yeah, I just think that it's well worth your time to revisit Juno. It is a little bit of a time capsule. It really does feel like a very 2007 movie, but that doesn't change the fact that it's good.
Oh, I completely agree. What do you think? Is this something that you would rewatch again? I mean, if it wasn't for the show, 5-10 years later, is this something that you would continue rewatching?
Yes, for sure. Like, I would watch it again. The only other movie that I can think of in the same bracket is 500 Days of Summer. Because they tackle not a simple issue, but like a common issue in a very different way. And these are a couple of movies where I think you can watch them again and again because of how casual and how lighthearted they are and not get bored.
While still being kind of heartbreaking.
Oh, I was a mess at one point in this film. Like, I was like, oh my God, what is happening? But no, I get it. I love these films.
So today we've been talking about Juno. Let us know if you watched it, if you liked it, if you hated it. You can tell us WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. You can find us at BFM Popcorn on both Twitter and Instagram. You've been listening to Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.